Listen to the voice of Jamaica Kincaid, a black writer from Antigua in the Caribbean, who wrote a scathing book called A Small Place. Do you know why people like me are shy about being capitalists? Well, it's because we, for as long as we have known you, were capital, like bales of cotton and sacks of sugar, and you were commanding cruel capitalists. And the memory of this is so strong, the experience so recent, that we can't quite bring ourselves to embrace this idea that you think so much of. As for what we were like before we met you, I no longer care. No periods of time over which my ancestors held sway, no documentation of complex civilizations is any comfort to me. Even if I really came from people who were living like monkeys in trees, it was better to be that than what happened to me, what I became after I met you. Listen to the rage, but also listen to the consciousness of history that drives the rage. Kincaid's rejection of capitalism as a path to freedom, as a path to progress, is grounded in the knowledge that black people in the Caribbean were, just yesterday as it were, seen as property, as commodities that were bought and sold to build that capitalism. Before the enslavement and forced migration of Africans, native peoples of the Caribbean were wiped out and worked to death with European invasion. And after enslavement ended, colonial brutality continued and intensified in the Caribbean and elsewhere to keep that capitalist system running. Kincaid's rage against what happened to her ancestors and its impact on her today is so great that she also rejects, at the same time, any sort of narrative that talks about a golden age of pre-colonial life and civilization. Flipping the racist script of capitalism as civilized and pre- and non-capitalist societies as primitive, Kincaid says she would rather be the savage of the racist histories than deal with what happened after Europe. Tonight, I want to present a glimpse of those brutal processes of slavery, colonialism, and settler colonialism before the rise of industrial capitalism, taking up the time period from the 15th to the 18th centuries. I ask, what would it look like to write a history that centers this rage in our understanding of capitalism, to have a thoroughly anti-Eurocentric global history? How would it meet the needs of peoples of color and native peoples trying to understand what's happened to us, how we are linked together, and how our histories are distinct? How some of us, yes, have always actively participated in maintaining, contributing to, and benefiting from these systems of oppression and exploitation. And from this to ask, what is our place within the fight against capitalism and within the movement for a socialist world? What does it actually mean to decolonize socialism? These are the questions that motivate my talk. As you can guess already from this, I'm not only challenging the open racists and cheerleaders for capitalism, but the residue of progressivism that appears in Marxist histories that also see the rise of capitalism as the pinnacle of human achievement. The idea that capitalism was revolutionary in the sense of monumental social and economic upheaval can turn into the notion that capitalism was revolutionary in the sense of something progressive, something to celebrate. I want to assert that for us to hold on to and center that rage and to fall into this progressivism is utterly contradictory. Capitalism was always a brutal and contradictory process, as Marx understood at his best, and we can't ever lose sight of that. Let me outline the scope of this talk. And for those of you who are interested, it's linked to my talk last year, Capitalism, Colonialism, and Revolution. I said then that all you need to know to get the talk was the Hindustani word lootna, which means to steal, from which we get the English word loot. This is still true. Colonialism was about looting and looting. The English even looted the word from us. Revolution is about taking back the loot. Not just from the colonizers, but after independence, from the ruling classes who kept working with the former colonizers who wanted to keep the loot flowing. Marxism, as it's developed over time, has offered tools to understand this history and to launch a struggle against it. But as I argued last year, Marxist theory and politics has only gotten sharpened on this over the years, with the development of imperialism itself, with the rise of anti-colonial struggle, and in the common turn in the 1920s, with the active participation of black and brown anti-racists and anti-colonial radicals. Tonight's talk focuses and expands last year's presentation. The first thing I'm doing is to focus the question of looting. How was the loot taken in the years before the Industrial Revolution in England and Western Europe around the early 18th century? And with that focus comes an expansion of the question beyond only colonialism. Since colonialism, slavery, and settler colonialism were central features of the looting of that period, what if we understood these processes of looting together as linked and simultaneous? Far too often, we talk about colonialism in Asia, settler colonialism in the Americas, in Australia and in the Pacific, and the transatlantic slavery of Africans as completely separate and distinct processes. This happens in academia with our different specializations, but it also happens on the left. Instead, we need to turn back to what I regard as Marx's own understanding of these processes as linked together, with England ultimately reaping the benefit of the massive profits that the Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, and French built through colonialism and slavery, tied with Britain's own role as prime colonizer and enslaver. Du Bois knew this. In his magisterial book, Black Reconstruction in 1935, Du Bois situates black struggle during and after the Civil War with an incredibly global view of racial oppression tied to capitalist exploitation. He speaks of, quote, that dark and vast sea of human labor in China and India, the South Seas and all Africa, in the West Indies and Central America, and in the United States, the great majority of mankind on whose bent and broken backs rest today the founding stones of modern industry, that they share a common destiny. As Kiangi Yamada Taylor put it in a 2008 article, Du Bois echoes Marx's description of the primitive accumulation of capital that laid the basis for the development of capitalism. Because in Capital, Marx also describes how colonialism, settler colonialism, and slavery combined to set the stage for the dawn of the era of capitalist production. Du Bois goes on to describe capitalism as, quote, spawning the world's raw material in luxury, cotton, wool, coffee, tea, cocoa, palm oil, fibers, spices, rubber, silks, lumber, copper, gold, diamonds, leather. All these are gathered up at prices lowest of the low, manufactured, transformed, and transported at fabulous gain, and the resultant wealth is distributed and displayed and made the basis of world power. Du Bois says, out of the exploitation of the dark proletariat comes surplus value filched from human beasts. Like Du Bois, the West Indian and Caribbean Marxists, writers and thinkers have always been right on top of this kind of global thinking. Because how can you talk about Caribbean history without talking about colonialism, settler colonialism, and slavery? These are all intertwined. C.L.R. James, The Black Jacobins, 1938, Eric Williams, Capitalism and Slavery, Césaire, Discourse on Colonialism, 1955, Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, 1972, The Writings of Jamaica Kincaid and Edward Danticat Today, all of these take the globe as their object and explain a remarkably intersectional history. And like for Kincaid, for Du Bois's global history was tied to the present day. Du Bois emphasized the centrality of native peoples and people of color, the descendants of the colonized and enslaved, to any model of workers' emancipation. He says, the emancipation of man, to use his language, is the emancipation of labor. And the emancipation of labor is the freeing of that basic majority of workers who are yellow, brown, and black. We don't use yellow anymore, but he's signifying Asians. Kincaid's rhetorical comment aside, it's important to say, to talk about pre-1400, and that the world Europe encountered was not an empty land, a blank slate as far as society and culture are concerned. European looting from 15th to 18th centuries was grounded on existing networks of trade and production that long preceded European encounters, while also creating new ones. These were lands full of diverse social formations, cultures, and languages, full of resources that people made use of and manipulated for their needs. And with the established practices for circulating the surplus, including trade over short and long distances, over land and sea, cities, states, and even empires developed in every continent, including the Incas and Mayans in the Americas, successive empires in China, empires in Mali and Benin in West Africa, Mongol and Turkish empires across West, Central, and South Asia, and on and on. The societies controlling reproduction and reproduction of human life and handling the surplus were quite varied, some organized by kin and lineage, other organized around a ruler protecting smaller rulers and landlords in exchange for tribute, and still others organized in different ways. Each was unique, complex, dynamic, and interacted with other societies. And given that there were different kinds of class societies, they were grounded themselves in all kinds of social hierarchies of gender, of class, of caste, and they led by producing ideologies that justified those hierarchies. In his amazing book, Europe and the Peoples Without History, Eric Wolf calls these kin-ordered and tributary modes of production. In fact, he sees feudalism in Europe as a kind of tributary society. You can run with that if you want. In How the West Came to Rule, Anivas and Nisangelu, if I'm saying their names right, use the tributary mode, but they also use terms like the slave mode of production and the nomadic mode of production. Whatever we make of these different categories, the key thing is that they're all attempts to address the incredible variety of human life in world history while retaining the basic Marxist emphasis that the best way to understand different societies and how they operated is to look at production, the way a society produces and reproduces what it needs, the ownership of how those things are produced, the relationship between the producers and the ruling class, the formation of states to protect those relations, how to relate to those outside the group, and how to deal with the problem of scarcity. Marxists and historians, by the way, have discarded the idea, thankfully so, that because pre-capitalist Europe was organized as feudalism, all of the world was also feudal before capitalism. To give just the complexity of life in the world before 1400, I'm going to talk a little bit about the trade routes that developed, showing the immense complexity of these societies and the states that enabled them. Let's take a look at the Silk Road. A network of trade routes, mostly by land and linked to those at sea, that was central to the economic, cultural, political, and religious interactions to many parts of the world from the 2nd century BC, reaching high points around the 13th century under the stability of Mongol rule, and declining by the 16th with the rise of the European sea trade. Over time, the Silk Road linked East Asia and Southeast Asia with South Asia, West Asia, or the Middle East, East Africa, North Africa, and Southern Europe, playing crucial roles in their development. Silk was exported from China, and many goods were traded, including gold, jade, tea, and spices, but it was also a conduit for the sharing of arts and culture, including religions and philosophies. The Silk Road presumed the production of goods and commodities, the presence of surpluses to circulate, the formation of social hierarchies and states to organize production and circulation, and to protect travelers. The road itself led to the growth of stations and cities and the concentration of people and labor. In order to trade across regions, merchants had to make use of known currencies, like gold coins, or give fixed values to items like Chinese silk or Indian sandalwood. People often didn't go the entire distance of the Silk Road, which was 4,000 miles, but traded between stations and cities like Samarkand in current Uzbekistan and Kashgar, which is a Uyghur city in western China. I have a note in here to take a little stop in Samarkand for a little minute, but I'm not going to. I'm going to move ahead. But it's the center of multicultural exchange for 2.5 millennia. So just, you know, you can Google it. Trade routes were spread throughout the world, with each set of routes building off and extending older ones, which were built by even older societies. In the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries, gold, salt, ivory, cola nuts, cloth, metal goods, beads, and slaves were traded across the Sahara to different regions of Africa, to Europe and West Asia via the Mediterranean, and via the Red Sea to South Asia. The Trans-Sahara routes connected at various times the Ghana Empire, the Mali and Songhai empires, to Morocco and Egypt, to the Kanem-Bornu Empire, and to Ethiopia. Another route from the Mediterranean to South Asia via the Red Sea was established between the 1st and 6th centuries. After the 9th century, it was controlled by Arab traders and extended all the way through the Indian Ocean. We really need a map, right? And the Maluku Islands in Indonesia, and to Guangzhou, known as Canton. Another, the Inca road system, extending 20,000 miles north and south on the Pacific border in South America, connecting present-day Colombia to Chile. Central to the military and economic power of the empire, connecting shrines at the top of the mountains, runners delivered passages along the road, llamas and alpacas transported goods along steep mountain paths. This is the bare edge of what historians have studied and known about Asia, Africa, America, American and other indigenous peoples before 1400. Beyond trade routes, we can learn about the structures of these societies, of families, of social hierarchies, of ideas about sexuality and gender, of religion, ideas about justice and liberation. Without some knowledge of these histories, we can fall into the trap of only valuing peoples and cultures when they contact Europe. And we're unable to see encounters with Europeans dialectically as meetings whose outcome was shaped not just by European society in action, but by the presence with all its strengths and limits of non-European peoples and societies. Consciously or not, such ideas work within that anti-indigenous and Eurocentric fiction that the world outside Europe was a flat, passive, unchanging, historyless place that for all intents and purposes was empty, a blank slate for Europe to write on. A fiction that Marx, borrowing the term from Hegel, falls into when he employs the concept of the Asiatic mode of production, as he does in 1853 writings on colonial India. If you want my defense of Marx, you can see it everywhere. I've written about it a lot. I'm talking about some of his problems. There's an opposite danger too. Without knowing this history, we might write onto the pre-1400 period a fictitious and mythological radical history, like the notion that the British Empire constructed the caste system in India out of thin air, or that gender identity for indigenous peoples was not only different before Europeans, but completely unbounded and liberated. As if decolonization is going back to a golden age, rather than forging a way ahead to a new one, past both the limitations of the pre-capitalist societies and the brutality of the capitalist world that grafted onto and conjoined with those older forms of production, exacerbated exploitation and oppression to hitherto unknown levels. Entered Western Europe. You okay? You all right? All right. Marxist writers all acknowledge that when Western Europe met this world, it did so from a position of relative disadvantage. The celebrated discovery of the New World that we have forced down our throats in the US school system so that every last kid can recite the names of Columbus's three ships was actually a process launched to break the relative isolation of Western Europe, blocked from world trade by the Ottoman Empire, which controlled the Eastern Mediterranean. The Iberian power Spain and Portugal launched the effort with financial support from Italian cities like Genoa and Venice, followed by the Dutch and France and England. The empires overlapped as they rose, facing challenges and competition, and they also fell. Spain dominated Mexico. I'm using the present day nation states, just so people know what we're talking about. Spain dominated Mexico, Central America, including the Caribbean and parts of South America, and the Philippines. Portugal ruled over parts of South America, notably Brazil, settled Atlantic islands off the coast of northern and western Africa, built forts and established bases in western, and rounded the Cape of Good Hope and set up shop in India and in the Indian Ocean. Alongside this, and especially with the demise of Portugal, the Dutch rose and wiped away almost all of their Indian Ocean bases in the 17th century, dominating Malaysia, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka, often with great brutality, which I'll get to. I'm gonna love the Dutch in this talk. Spanish decline also allowed for the English and the French to establish Spanish decline is what allowed England and France to establish settlements in North America and the Caribbean in the early 17th century, and then in India through the 18th century. After a series of wars with France in the early and mid 18th century, which took place in Europe, but also in India and North America, England began to establish its global dominance, even despite the loss of its North American colonies. And so the looting began with immense destruction. You know, it makes sense that people talk about settler colonialism and genocide in the Americas, Australia and Pacific, slavery in terms of Africans, and colonialism in Asia. These are areas where such developments were very prominent. The utter devastation of the Americas population through disease and forced labor. It's unimaginable. 145 million people estimated in the Western Hemisphere before Columbus. It declines by 90 to 95% by 130 million by 1691. The Maori population dropped 57% from its highest point. Australian Aborigines declined 84% after British colonialism. The trading of 12 to 13 million Africans, with 2 million lost at sea during the Middle Passage. The territorial conquest of South Asia and Southeast Asia, with settlements and posts around China, stand out, with colonial-era famines taking millions of lives in India, with opium forced onto the Chinese by the British, making addicts of an estimated 1 in 10 people in China. So I understand why we talk about these things separately. But slavery, settler colonialism, and colonialism were not only related processes across different continents, but were intertwined within continents. So just some examples. Indigenous peoples of the Americas were also enslaved and forced into labor at every point. In North America, Alan Galay argues, English colonists paid Native Americans to hunt their neighbors for sale into the Caribbean and South America. The encomienda system in colonial Spain was a genocidal system of forced labor under brutal conditions with an incredibly high death rate, such that one historian says it had driven many millions of native peoples in Central and South America to early and agonizing deaths. Settler colonialism was a process in Asia as well, and indigenous peoples were wiped out across the Indian Ocean. Finally, colonial posts were set up in Africa and impacted the interior of the continent well before the scramble for Africa in the late 19th century. It seems to me, after preparing for this talk actually, that there's a much more stronger historical connection than I used to think between the process of this transatlantic slave trade, later territorial colonization, and the condition of sub-Saharan African nation states today. So I'm going to give you some examples of this history to kind of show how these things were related. I keep saying they're related, right? Listen to me, I said they're related. All right, just here's a timeline of Portuguese activities in the 15th and 16th centuries. It is just mind-blowing. So in 1415, not 1492, in 1415, they take Ceuta, which is on the North African coast across from the Strait of Gibraltar. In 1420, the Madeira settlement off Morocco. 1448, so we're going down the African coast on the Atlantic, okay? 1448, the Arguin Island Fort off Mauritania. 1482, they'll build the Elmina Fort in Ghana, known as Mina, a central port for the slave trade. 1483, they sail to the mouth of the Congo, we're going down, right? And interact with the Congo Kingdom. 1487, they round the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa and find an eastern path to Asia. In 1497, Vasco da Gama sails to East Africa and the Malabar coast in India, opening up the spice trade. 1500, Cabral lands in South America. You following me? Where we are? All right. The first Brazil wood is shipped to Lisbon. 1505, a Sofala base is established around Mozambique. In the 1520s, sugar cultivation begins in northeast Brazil. Indigenous people are working there in various capacities of labor. And in 1530, enslaved Africans start coming to Brazil. Eric Wolfe generalizes it this way. Thus, the spice trade came to link Lisbon with Asia. Sugar connected the Portuguese capital with America, and the slave trade forged a chain across the southern Atlantic. From this time on, all struggles for dominance within the European world would take on a global character as the European states sought to control the oceans and oust their competitors from points of vantage gained in Asia, Africa, or America. The several continents would be drawn into one worldwide system of connections. To take this from another angle, let's look at different phases of the African slave trade to the Americas from the 15th to the 19th centuries. The numbers of the enslaved are dated, So these numbers are not right. But the pattern is what I'm describing. 1451 to 1600, 275,000 slaves for labor in the silver mines and plantations of the Spanish colonies and sugar workers in Portuguese Brazil. Over the course of the 17th century, it bumps up to 1.3 million slaves in response to the development of sugarcane cultivation in the Caribbean and tobacco in North America. In the 18th century, the Age of Enlightenment, 6 million Africans are forcibly exported between 1701 to 1810, 6 million, mainly to British Jamaica and French Saint Domingo. And 1810 to 1870, the number goes down to 2 million, mainly to Cuba, the leading sugar producer in the Caribbean. In other words, 80% of all enslaved Africans come to the Americas between 1701 and 1850. While slavery as an institution was finally abolished and destroyed through a combination of the efforts of the resistance of the enslaved, liberal demands for abolition, and industrial capitalism's need for heightened productivity of free and waged labor, the period leading up to the Industrial Revolution saw an intensification of the slave trade, with the products made and sold through slavery reaping massive profits and laying the groundwork for industrial capitalism. Some Europeans during the so-called Age of Enlightenment were getting the picture, in whatever limited ways. And Candide, the philosopher Voltaire, has a character say, seeing the brutality in the Dutch Caribbean, that this brutality is the price of eating sugar in Europe. Speaking of the Dutch, they haven't received their due. And I hope through the course of this conference, like the inter-imperialist rivalry happening in the World Cup is messed up for you, okay? One of the key sites of Dutch brutality in the 17th century is the Maluku Islands in present-day Indonesia. In the process of knocking out Portuguese power and gaining control of the Indian Ocean trade, the Dutch East India Company, or the VOC, made a deal with the Sultan of Ternate, who ruled the Maluku Islands, in return for protection from the Spanish in the Philippines. Okay, we're in Malaysia. The Philippines are right there, and that's the Spanish. So in return for protection from the Spanish, the VOC gets a monopoly over the production of cloves, which are on the island of Ambonia, and nutmeg and mace, which are the island of Banda, and exclusive contracts with local traders and producers. But individual traders kept trading illegally, and island inhabitants kept selling to them. So to protect their interests, the Dutch went on a rampage. In 1621, all the inhabitants of Banda were either killed or transported to Dutch Batavia, which is the capital of the Dutch East Indies and is present-day Jakarta. So they're either killed or transported and replaced with Dutch settlers, given land for planting nutmeg trees and VOC-owned slaves for cultivation. You see how it's all mixing together. All the clove trees on Banda were destroyed so that only Ambonia and a few other islands could grow cloves, ensuring the VOC control of clove production. The Sultan was paid money for his loss of income from the illegal traders. The payment was literally called in the Dutch books extirpation money. When the labor supply, which is a, you know, extermination, when the labor supply in Ambonia fell in 1651, 12,000 people from the Seram Islands were forcibly moved there. We can go on and on. The VOC and the British East India Company were cut from the same cloth. The British had a stronger capitalist presence, and so, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean goes after them. All right, whatever, I keep saying that. That joke has to go. While they were trading companies, they were given monopolies of trade by their countries, the power to declare war and make peace, and relative autonomy from their home countries. The ultimate dominance of the English over the Dutch in terms of capitalist development and imperial expansion shouldn't minimize the VOC's record of settler colonial violence worldwide. Add to that the legacy of Afrikaner brutality in South Africa, and you have the Dutch as a full-blown founding member of the Colonizer Enslaver Hall of Shame. In his just published research on the Dutch Empire, Pepin Brandon, am I saying the right, people know him, shows how wrong conservative Dutch historians have been to minimize Dutch colonialism and slavery, their impact on the development of Dutch wealth, and the impact on of the Dutch financial system on the development of Western Europe. Indeed, Brandon calls for an extension to Dutch colonialism and slavery, what Eric Williams says in Capitalism and Slavery about the centrality of British Caribbean slavery to British industrial capitalism. Eric Williams makes an argument about Britain and its colonies and plantations, and Brandon is saying we need to extend this to talk about the Dutch. Brandon, pointing to the profits from the products of Dutch slave plantations in the Atlantic Ocean, shows them to be responsible for up to 10% of the Dutch GDP by 1770. I was really happy to see that Brandon calls for the need to bring together scholars who study the Dutch, Indonesia, and the Caribbean. While Brandon studies the Dutch Atlantic plantations, he notes that conditions in the Indian Ocean plantations were very different. So this is a quote. While in the Atlantic world, plantation slavery became the point towards which all commercial activities gravitated. But in Asia, the colonial empires mostly combined many different forms of coerced labor at the same time, so it becomes hard to estimate what constitutes profits from slavery per se. Further, while the Atlantic plantations were owned by Europeans, in Asia the VOC often relied on intermediaries such as kings, landed aristocracies, or Chinese merchants and tenant farmers. We need to be able to take on this unevenness. If you couldn't follow that completely, it's all right. The basic point is what I'm making now. We need to be able to take on this unevenness even within the Dutch Empire or other empires and still study the big picture. This is happening everywhere. So take, for example, the establishment of the East India Company by Britain in 1600 and the Virginia Company in 1606 at the same time as part of the same English strategy of expanding trade. The colonizers were very conscious about these global connections. Consider the British gains at the Treaty of Utrecht. If you're confused by this history, okay, I'm going to lose time on this, but I don't care. If you're confused by this history, I've been a revolutionary socialist for what? I don't know, 25 years. I'm a supposed scholar of colonialism. I'm reading some of this for the first time in preparing for this talk. And I just want to get it out there. The colonizers were very conscious of these global connections. Consider the British gains at the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713 and 1714. Following a war that ended Spain and France's bid to combine their nations and form a massive European power. So here's what the British got. On the one hand, a 30-year license to send thousands of African slaves to the Spanish colonies in the Americas. They get a 30-year license from Spain to sell African slaves to Spanish colonies. On the other hand, they're granted control of the Hudson Bay in Canada, ending French claims in the area of the expanding fur trade. So their eye is on both North and South America as they settle a war in Europe to weaken the Spanish and the French. Combining colonialism, settler colonialism, and slavery also allows for a better understanding of the global development of white supremacy, beyond the clear and demonstrable rise of racism as an ideology in the U.S. context as a consequence of slavery and anti-slavery revolts. British Madras was acquired in 1639. It was the main East India Company base until the end of the 17th century. They were first in Western India, but the Mughal rule and taxation demands were too high, and the Surat and Western India kind of merchant financial arrangements were too kind of tight. They couldn't break in. So they go around to Southeast India and the Coromandel coast. British Madras gives an idea of what their rule would look like. More than 100 years before they really established their place in India, Madras was divided into White Town and Black Town areas. White Town had 50 European employees of the East India Company, 25 unaffiliated European merchants, 60 European sea captains, and a few others. Black Town, 10,000 local inhabitants. Between them, 200 European soldiers and 400 non-European soldiers protected White Town. The official end of the slave trade under the pressure of industrial capitalism in the early 19th century. Where are we at?
5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes.
You may work.
All right, we're at 5 minutes. Okay. This continues. I'll just give you one image, the way these things are connected. Lisa Lowe, who's not a Marxist, begins The Intimacies of Four Continents, which is a book about the critique of liberalism, right? She begins by talking about how the first Chinese indentured servants to arrive in the Caribbean crossed the Atlantic at the time the British are abolishing slavery. Okay, so just, right? So the liberals abolish slavery, working the sugar plantations continues, right? Through a different form of labor with a different group of people. And if you look at Eric Williams, he talks about that. He says India replaced Africa, talking about that time period. And so to get a sense of that rage of Kincaid, right? This keeps happening in one way or another, one form or another. So I have 5 minutes left. I'm just gonna make 2 points. The first point, and I have a whole nice thing written about it too, but I need to stop. The first point is about thinking about non-European actors in all of this. Non-European peoples, and I've tried to make that point already, but just with two details. Non-European peoples were participants in this process in two key ways I wanted to highlight. One is resistance. Europeans cross the Cape of Good Hope and come to India, for example, 300 years before they actually get a foothold within the territory. Europeans are participating in the slave trade around the continent of Africa years before they actually colonize the interior. This has to do with resistance, this has to do with large states, this has to do with merchant networks, and the inability of the Europeans to get in. So it's not linear. It's not that the history and the end of these situations is already foretold. And with Spain and Portugal, you can see not all European powers make it. They open things up. They amass great silver. They're not the ones who develop industrial capitalism. And so this is a complex process whose end is not foretold, right? And so that's one is about resistance. And the second point I wanted to make is about collaboration. Native Americans participating in the fur trade, right? Sometimes as equals, because they were the ones with connection with the trappers, right? Africans participating in the slave trade because of some pre-existing patterns that were there in Africa, but then developing centralized states around, you know, the pressure coming from the greater demand for slavery, as we saw with the growth of sugar in the Caribbean and elsewhere. And so there's longer and complicated discussions to have about this. The right wing loves to talk about black and brown complicity in these things in order to let Europe off the hook. What historians have shown is that these were complex societies, and part of it is that there's agency. There's people who are involved. The most marginalized and oppressed in those societies are still getting the short end of the stick, right? We have to talk about those things because they were human societies. We have to talk about those things, and at the same time, the intensified push coming as the centuries progress changes those dynamics fundamentally. The last thing I'll say is I didn't really talk about theory. I didn't talk about the origins of capitalism, the transition to capitalism, and all of those rich debates that are out there. I'm arguing that the stuff that I've talked about applies regardless of what positions you take on the modes of production debate, etc. So I invite people to talk about those things and to bring in the theoretical dimensions. I stayed away from it. I have theoretical positions. I think some of those came through in the talk. But I stayed away from it for two reasons. One is what Jairus Banerjee calls the problem of theory as history, where we make grand theoretical claims about things without necessarily knowing, or even sometimes feeling we need to know, the histories that are out there. So I wanted to avoid that. And secondly, is that sometimes when we talk about those histories, we only talk about European history, and we don't talk about the history. So again, going back to Kincaid, maybe I'll just end with this last thing. I read somewhere, going back to Kincaid, how do you write a history around that rage? It was fucked up from the beginning, right? And it's continued to be. I read somewhere on Facebook, Angela Davis had a quote. She said, bourgeois ideology, and particularly its racist ingredients, must really possess the power of dissolving real images of terror into obscurity and insignificance, and of fading horrible cries of suffering human beings into barely audible murmurings, and then silence. And I want you, if you have the time, go back to that passage in Marx where he talks about primitive or what I call primary accumulation. And I hope today's history and talk in trying to refuse to let those murmurings go away into silence. Hopefully that opens things up for you in this discussion. Going back to Du Bois, I think what it shows is the need to make anti-imperialism, anti-racism central to the socialist movements that we're part of, but also the presence and leadership of people of color and native peoples because of their experience, because they're the direct descendants of the people who were colonized and enslaved. And without that, we can't really build an effective socialist movement in this country. Thank you.